Sophie O'Brien.
I'm Lorraine Healy.
And I'm Matt Kibibrand. This is How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show. Today is Tuesday, November 18th, 2025.
Coming up, we speak with Colorado State University scientist Melinda Smith about grassland scientists around the world, including in Colorado.
The scientists warn that global warming makes mega droughts more common, which can turn grasslands into dust bowls.
We begin with a look at some of the recent news in science. From us, the CU Earthlings, students interested in science.
The rise of artificial intelligence means that we should talk to each other more. That's the message from researchers at the University of Cambridge. The Cambridge researchers warn that AI doesn't fit well with traditional teachings, where students read, memorize, and then show what they've learned through tests and papers. In this setup, it's easy to let AI handle the hard parts. Summarizing readings, organizing ideas, even drafting assignments. The researchers warn that relying on it too much can weaken the students' own thinking and reasoning. That's why Cambridge researchers recommend a shift towards more interactive, conversation-based learning. This method, known as dialectic learning, has students and teachers exploring problems together, looking at ideas from multiple angles. Through dialectic learning, the Cambridge group writes, AI can broaden perspectives rather than a substitute for thought and helps them understand concepts by discussing and reasoning through them. The author adds that collaborative problem solving may be a skill badly needed for dealing with complex global problems such as climate change. Through this thought paper has been published in the British Journal Educational Technology.
Imagine a world where the bride's life depends on the ceremony's success, and where happily ever after starts with killing a queen. That's the reality for parasitic ants. The main job of the drones, meeting the king ants, if you will, is to fertilize the eggs. Lots of eggs. From then on, it's the ant queens that do the fighting. A newly mated female can only survive if she takes over another queen's colony. Usually that means a brutal head-to-head fight with the reigning queen. But the battle isn't the only way to win a war. Now scientists in Japan have documented a takeover that's far more sneaky. Instead of barging in, the new queen-to-be hangs around the ant colony's entrance, brushing against the workers. She steals their scent, a trick called host odor pre-acquisition, so the guard ants think she belongs. Then she slips inside, heads straight for the old queen, and sprays her with formic acid. It's a harsh chemical humans use in things like toilet bowl cleaners. Ants normally use tiny amounts to sting enemies, but here, the spray makes the old queen smell like an outsider. The queen's worker daughters, fooled by the scent, go in for the kill. With no fight at all, the infiltrating parasitic ant becomes the new queen. Cared for by the old queen's orphan worker daughters, workers who have no idea they've been tricked. This spray-and-switch strategy was first spotted by an amateur ant enthusiast, Taku Shimada, who now appears as the lead author on the new study, published this week in the Cell Press Journal, Current Biology.
In other science news, tonight you can learn about 3D printing to create better body parts. CU Boulder scientist Jason Burdick is a leader in this field. His 3D printed materials include internal band-aids that are stretchy enough to move along with a beating heart. Burdick will be speaking about these amazing 3D printed bionic materials at CU Boulder's BioFrontiers building tonight at 6 p.m.
This Wednesday afternoon, CU Boulder will host a distinguished research lecture that features Alexis Templeton. Templeton will talk about how the search of Earth's hydrogen reserves may help us move towards cleaner energy and maybe uncover new forms of life. Templeton's talk will be at Euclid and 17th in the Chancellor's Hall. That's on Wednesday. Talk starts at 4 p.m.
These have been reports from the CU Earthlings, CU students interested in science. For How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show, I'm Lorraine Healy.
And I'm Matt Kibibrand.
A dust storm hit, and it hit like thunder. It dusted us over and it covered us under. Blocked out the traffic and blocked out the sun. Straight for home all the people did run, singing so long.
You're tuned in to How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show. I'm Abby O'Brien. This song by Woody Guthrie is about the Dust Bowls of the 1930s and 40s. These Dust Bowls destroyed grasslands, crops, and grazing throughout the Midwest, including in Colorado. People died from despair because of the dust. People died of starvation and lung disease. As for the land that was blowing away, some areas took decades to recover.
I'm Lorraine Healy. You might think that Dust Bowls will never happen again, but worldwide research led by Colorado State University scientist Melinda Smith indicates that climate change and risky land management are making grasslands more vulnerable than ever to Dust Bowls. To reach these conclusions, Smith led a team of nearly 200 scientists from around the world whose experiments have documented the danger. For more, here's CSU scientist Melinda Smith talking with How on Earth volunteer Shelley Schlender.
Melinda Smith, what has you profoundly interested in grasslands and what has you worried?
My interest in grasslands started when I worked for the City of Boulder Open Space Department.
People tend to think that Boulder County is mainly about mountains and trees and forests, but a lot of the open space in Boulder is beautiful prairie grasses and farmlands. What made you fall in love with grasslands?
I loved identifying grasses. And what's really unique about Boulder County is that it has fantastic remnant tall grass prairie.
Tall grass is as tall as us. It's taller than most of the grass in eastern Colorado.
I worked at the short grass prairie, or sometimes it's called the short grass steppe. These grasses probably grow no more than 20 centimeters.
About ankle high to
below the knee.
Short grass prairie. You think it's worth saving, among other reasons, because of the carbon storage in grasses.
That's correct. Much of the carbon that they store is below ground. What you see above ground is about 20% of the carbon versus 80% below ground. Grasses are so crucial for soil health, for keeping the soil there and allowing for water to get into deep aquifers and recharge groundwater.
One thing that you're pointing out is that grasslands aren't just the stubby things above the ground. In Kansas at the Land Institute, which is an area studying grasses, there's this phenomenal grass that they dug up. And here's this little bit of grass that's about knee high above the ground. And then here's the root system that goes in every direction for about 20 feet.
Yes. And that's what we have here in the short grass prairie.
So we have these knee-high grasses maybe or ankle-high grasses, but the root systems go out 10, 20 feet in every direction to help get water into those aquifers, which are underground rivers.
Yes.
A lot more water than our above-ground rivers. They're what farmers use to irrigate their crops.
Yes, and for exurban developments, they rely on these groundwater sources as well.
If you don't live in a big city and you need water, you can tap into the aquifer. It's a neat system. How much of the earth is grasslands like this?
It's approximately 40% of the earth's terrestrial land surface.
So almost half of it.
Yes.
Does the carbon stay in the roots, even if a wildfire happens?
Yes, that's the difference between forests and grasslands. Most of the carbon is above ground in forest. So if you get a fire, a lot of it is released up the atmosphere. With grasslands, you burn them, but up to 80% could be still below ground and stored.
And the next spring, it pops back up as bright green grass. It's really a beautiful thing. So you can burn a prairie and it doesn't hurt it, unlike a forest where if you burn it in the hot fires we're having, it really hurts it.
Yes.
Puts a lot of carbon into the air. We're saying so many good things about grasslands.
They're amazing.
They are amazing. But let's tell the bad news now about your drought studies.
Yeah, so we've been fortunate to have an amazing group of scientists who were interested in understanding drought impacts on grasslands and shrublands. These colleagues across the globe worked together to perform an experiment. And that experiment was unique in that everyone was imposing the same kind of drought.
You all did the same recipe of experiment. You all baked the same cake.
That's right.
Seeing what would happen to a grassland if you kept it too dry.
Really dry. We're talking a 1 in 100 year drought. What people did is they looked at their long-term records and they said, ooh, based on a 30-year record, what would you predict would be a 1 in 100 year dry year. And then what we did was we used rainfall manipulation shelters is what we call them.
It's basically something that lets light in, but it doesn't let rain down.
That's right.
You kept the water away from the grass.
But we didn't completely exclude it. What they do is they eliminate a proportion of each rainfall. And what that does is it actually mimics natural drought. With natural drought, what you get is smaller events, fewer events, and longer dry periods.
Well, just a second, Melinda Smith. I thought that prairies are made for semi-arid conditions and they can survive a drought. But then your study showed that they can not survive a mega drought.
That's right. Because we not only imposed this drought for a single year, we did it over multiple years, kind of mimicking what happened during the Dust Bowl.
The Dust Bowl happened in the 1930s. My grandmother was in the Dust Bowl.
Oh, wow.
In Kansas with face masks on. In those days, they called them handkerchiefs. Whole fields would blow away that you couldn't see because there was so much dust in the air. It was terrifying.
It was a terrible drought. It's often referred to as a decade-long drought, but there was really just a kind of a core 4 years in that drought that were really dry and that are expected to occur more frequently with changing climate.
They're expected to occur more frequently?
Yes.
But why?
Warming of the atmosphere can decrease the amount of rainfall. That's one way it can change, but it also is increasing the variability. So people might be listening to this and saying, yeah, but it's been wet recently. So we might get wet years, but we're getting a lot more dry years too. So we're pushing systems to their limits.
That's and we're getting more pockets where they don't just have one dry year, they have four in a row.
Multiple years.
We've got the grasslands that are designed to pop back with flowers and green grass after a bad drought year. But what happens after 4 years of drought?
With 4 years of drought, what we found is, particularly for those grasslands that were on the drier end, like the ones in Colorado, we call them semi-arid grasslands, those were actually the most vulnerable to this multi-year drought.
But they were made, Melinda Smith, Colorado State University. Grasslands are made to be dry, but you're saying that if there's too many years of drought, they can quickly die. Surely that means that if there's just another rain, they'll pop back.
We see that in some cases, but the drier grasslands, like the semi-arid grasslands in Colorado, they're kind of on the edge. You know, some would say, wait, they've been dry for a long time. Like, aren't they used to that? Well, actually, being able to cope with dry conditions doesn't mean you can cope with really drought conditions. And that's the difference we're seeing. Drought is a very different thing than just dry years. It pushes these plants to their limits and actually causes death.
Death?
Yeah.
Does this mean that the roots themselves can't reach the aquifers? The aquifers have gone down too low to reach. They're not getting water from the sky. So the roots die.
That's correct. We saw with our site, for example, in Colorado, the one in which many livestock growers depend on in eastern Colorado, with a four-year drought, we saw the death of the most common grass. We saw a elimination of root system, essentially desertification.
We're not talking about shortbread and ice cream at the end of a meal. What is desertification here?
That's where you get loss of plant cover, a change in soil health.
In the Dust Bowl, the ground no longer had roots to hold it together. It no longer had soil bacteria and microbes that held soil together. It started to blow like it was the sand dunes in the Sahara.
That's right.
Are we at risk of not just having a Dust Bowl, but turning Colorado into a desert?
We're certainly at risk of a very damaged ecosystem. And what we found after we stopped imposing the drought experimentally, the recovery is actually quite prolonged. And we're going to have to be very active in our management of these systems if we're going to, you know, increase resilience.
With a good rain, a grassland comes back the next spring. How many years does it take an area that's gone through a mega drought to come back?
After the Dust Bowl, it took more than 20 years for some grasslands to recover.
20 years.
That's why there was a lot of intervention that happened afterwards. So there was some pretty widespread efforts to seed areas with native grasses. That's actually what we're doing in our experiment to explore the, you know, how management after drought can help with recovery from the drought.
So 20 years' time with careful management to try to speed up how long it takes.
Yeah.
Are there areas in the world where this desertification is already underway?
There are areas that have experienced extended drought, but they're also often coupled with mismanagement. And so it's hard sometimes to know exactly which factor was contributing to that. But drought tends to be a signature associated with desertification in many cases.
We're getting more times where an area of the world may stumble into these extended dry periods.
That's right. And that's the other thing that I'm particularly interested in is, can we think about how we respond after drought that might set us up to be even more resilient to the next one? Can we think about seeding in native species that are actually more drought adapted? Can we think about how we manage after drought, for example, graze in a different way, or take advantage of wet periods after droughts where we can speed up recovery in ways through our intervention?
If we don't do that, then what do we lose?
We could lose soil health for cattle grazing, for example. We can lose infiltration of water.
When you say infiltration of water, you mean that a healthy grassland helps rainfall go deep down into the soil to refeed the aquifers.
Yeah, they're like sponges.
They're like sponges, yeah.
Yeah. The root systems actually create channels for water to flow down deep into the soil. And without those, what you often see is runoff and erosion.
Runoff and erosion.
Yeah.
I see you there with the eastern Colorado grassland that's like a velvet blanket across
the soil.
Yeah, really beautiful.
So long, it's been good to know you. This dusty old dust is getting my home.
You're tuned to How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show. I'm Abby O'Brien. We're listening to Woody Guthrie's song about the Dust Bowl days of the 1930s.
I'm Matt Kiebebrand. Just 4 years of drought in a row could turn eastern Colorado's short grass into a dust bowl. That's according to Colorado State University scientist Melinda Smith. Smith has led a team of nearly 200 scientists around the world who are analyzing the risk of dust bowls, but also ways to reduce the risk. Up next, How on Earth volunteer Shelley Schlender talks with CSU's Melinda Smith about dust bowl risks in the Middle East.
In the Middle East, they're already experiencing some extreme pockets of drought. One city that is in the news recently is Tehran. The entire city might have to be evacuated because they're running out of water.
Yeah, if we're not able to recharge the aquifers that we rely upon, or we're not managing them in a way that is sustainable, these kinds of events can exacerbate that mismanagement, and it can lead to essentially the well running dry. We didn't see that during the Dust Bowl, but that's partly because we weren't so intensively using the water back then.
That's right. The aquifers, the underground rivers and lakes that we have relied on for hundreds of years in the United States, some of them are down so far that it's not a 20-foot deep well anymore. It's a 100-foot deep well.
That's
not so good. Are there some countries where they have managed to replenish their aquifers? I hear about India as one example where there are movements to recreate lakes to hold monsoon water to replenish the aquifers.
We're involved in the study that is in Kansas. They're exploring how they can use solar installations to help with recharge of aquifers.
Solar panels.
Yeah.
Putting solar panels in a field to help recharge the aquifer. Well, how does that do it?
They're putting them in areas that have intact native grasslands. And the idea is that if they can collect the water and funnel it into areas that have intact grassland, that might enhance further recharge because they're directing the water in areas where we know infiltration is good.
Now, what you're describing is similar to the system in India where they study which parts of the landscape are most likely to let water go deep into the ground. And it has to do with the geologic fissures in the ground and the cracks. They look for places like that and say, let's dig a lake here so that more water can get into the ground. And in your case, you're saying, let's put more solar panels around this area where the water would run off the solar panels into the places that are kind of cracks that could fill the aquifers.
That's right, because in Kansas, a lot of the area has limestone, a lot of fissures in it. And so it's actually a really unique place to try to do this type of groundwater recharge using solar arrays.
Well, you look like you may feel optimistic about this, even though your study with, what was it, 100 scientists around the world?
More than that, 170 plus.
170 plus from around the world showed that this risk of desertification, grasslands drying up so much that the roots die and the land is left exposed to blow, is much higher than people have realized. The risk is much greater.
It is. But there is some hope because not all grasslands are that way, right? We know that there are some grasslands that actually look quite resilient. That's the next frontier, is trying to understand why grasslands vary in their drought response.
What's an example here in the United States or Colorado of a more resilient grassland?
Tall grass prairie.
The tall grass prairie around Lawrence, Kansas and Manhattan, Kansas. Yes, that's a pretty area. As opposed to the eastern Colorado short grass prairie grasslands. You know, the last time I drove through Kansas, it was blowing.
Oh, I bet it was.
Around Goodland, which is western Kansas, there were huge plumes of dust in the air. It was a little hard to see driving. The dust was that deep and thick.
After the Dust Bowl, there was a concerted effort to reestablish perennial vegetation, grasslands again. Soil Conservation Service was established, all of these efforts. And now we're starting to creep more towards where we were when the Dust Bowl happened, where we have a lot more of land that is plowed and in agriculture. And what our study suggests is that if you have that kind of drought happen in areas that are cropped with annual crops and things like that, the impacts would be much more rapid.
Meaning soybeans, wheat, corn.
Yeah, because when you have multiple years of drought, you cannot plant, can't successfully establish a crop in one of those years. The one thing that we can say about native grasslands is at least they can buffer the system for a little while, but there's even limits to that.
So you studied the grasslands. All you can do is predict that if you have a lot of plowed fields, it's even worse.
Yes.
The risk is even worse.
That's correct.
Does the risk get even worse if it gets hotter?
Most certainly. And see, that's the other aspect of our study, is we just manipulated rainfall. We just changed how much was falling on the ground. We did not include increase in temperatures. And the two often go hand in hand with drought, particularly, you know, when you think about a natural drought, because those occur at a larger scale. And there's often a feedback. You lose growth of plants. They grow less. You have increase in temperatures because soil warms. And so it becomes this kind of positive feedback. It gets hotter, it gets drier, it gets hotter, it gets drier, right? We did not mimic that. And so what we suggest from our study is that while it suggests profound losses, it's actually probably underestimating that with natural droughts.
It's good to find out bad news if it means that we can be a little more vigilant, perhaps.
And that's right.
It's a big problem up ahead.
You know, you could argue it's like, okay, that's a little doom and gloom, right? But what we can tell from these kinds of studies is we can identify these places where there is hope, right? Where there can be pretty high resilience. And we can identify those that might be really vulnerable. And it's those vulnerable systems that we need to focus on and try to understand what we can do to mitigate those impacts.
You're being the lookout scouts.
That's right.
You're being the lookout scouts so that people, if they want, can stay ahead of the problem.
I'll just mention again, this was such an effort by so many people, but it was a grassroots effort.
So it was a grassroots effort about prairies and grasslands, but also you didn't get federal funding to speak of or tax dollars?
We received federal funding to coordinate people, but we actually got no funding to actually do the experiments. It was all an individual effort. Each investigator said, it's worth it to me to try to find a way to do this experiment so that I can be part of this larger network. And what it resulted in is this amazing coordinated effort that revealed things about drought and our understanding of drought and grasslands and shrublands.
Maybe that'll make it more believable to people that this is a real issue.
That really was the motivation for this. The studies up until we did our study, they varied a lot in the way people imposed drought and how long they did it for, all of these things. And so you could always kind of be wondering, is it really that way? Or is it because of all the different ways people have looked at drought in the past? And we wanted to get rid of that kind of uncertainty and be able to say with certainty, using a coordinated effort.
So you all use the same recipe. You all baked the same cake.
That's right.
In science terms, what's that called? You all reproduced the same experiment and got the same results.
That's right.
A dust storm hit and it hit like thunder. It dusted us over and it covered us under.
I'm Matt Kiwibrand. This is music by Woody Guthrie about the Dust Bowls of the 1930s. Shelley Schlender has been talking with Colorado State University scientist Melinda Smith. Smith says global warming is making mega droughts more common, which increases the risk that grasslands will turn into dust bowls.
Been good to know ye so long. It's been good to know ye so long. It's been good to know ye. This dusty old dust is getting my home. And I've got to be drifting along.
That's all for this edition of How on Earth. Our executive producer is Beth Bennett.
This week's show was produced and engineered by Shelley Schlender.
Our theme music was written and produced by Josh Cutler. Additional music from Space Science and Woody Guthrie.
Visit our website at howonearthradio.org to find past episodes, extended interviews, and hot links to topics we've talked about today.
Questions or comments? Call the KGNU comment line at 303-447-9911. For How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show, I'm Abby O'Brien.
I'm Matt Kiwibrand.
And I'm Lorraine Healy.